Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features audio from the Saturday night plenary of the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled One Fight, Many Fronts. The first speaker is Paul Jay, a journalist, award-winning filmmaker, and founder and senior editor of the Real News Network. The second speaker is Dr. Gerald Horn, an African-American historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African Studies at the University of Houston. The third speaker is Juan D. Gonzalez, an award-winning broadcast journalist, investigative reporter, and co-host of Democracy Now! And now, Paul Jay.
I've been asked to set up this evening, and I'm going to give a broad sketch of where I think we humans are at. The more I looked at it, the more it scared the hell out of me. But that's sort of the point. We need to tell people the whole truth about the urgency of this historical moment, the existential threat of this moment. And, of course, it can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be paralyzing. While the fight for health care for all, a higher minimum wage, against systemic racism, for unionization, and all necessary reforms and fights to do with the day-to-day struggle, they're critical to engaging people, but we also need to tell people the whole truth about just how dire the big picture is. There's no need to treat working people, or ourselves for that matter, as infants. The whole culture is aimed at the infantilization of political discussion. We either believe that America is already great or make America great again, but it's all a religion of Americanism, and it's all meant to make us willing children who will march into battle or just resign ourselves to things as they are. As catastrophic and savage as capitalism was during the 20th century, continuous wars and genocides, deep economic crisis, and the constant threat of nuclear annihilation, the system proved to be resilient. The global elites did find a kind of equilibrium. Capitalism did not come to an end, and attempts at socialism failed. While many societies around the world have been destroyed, millions of people slaughtered in war, and many more living in deep poverty, the truth is, the majority of people in the advanced capitalist world are doing okay. In the United States, there are as many families earning over $100,000 a year as there are earning under $30,000 in actual numbers. But as resilient as capitalism has proved to be, I don't think this world order is sustainable. The elites are no longer capable or willing to deal with grave systemic threats, even when it's in their own long-term interest to do so. We're in a different kind of moment than we've ever faced before. Of course, nuclear weapons posed an existential threat in the past, but at least the elites saw that ending human life on Earth wasn't in their interest. That is, so far that's true. Because as crazy as the prospect for nuclear war is, they have not given up their deteriorating, hair-triggered nuclear arsenals. And they actually contemplate the use of localized nuclear weapons. As you know, first Obama and now Trump is spending billions expanding Americans' nuclear capability. While it's unlikely the elites will deliberately launch a nuclear Armageddon, we're all living in denial if we think that an accidental triggering of such isn't possible. The hair trigger policy means there's around 10 minutes to decide if what looks like an attack actually is one or is a glitch in the software. It's a Cold War posture still in place in the United States and Russia. It's Dr. Strangelove's doomsday machine, and we can't have faith in the political leadership of these elites that the current leadership of either the Republican or Democratic Party or the billionaires that bankroll them to face up to this danger. One would think it's in the interest of the elites themselves to deal with this. But the military-industrial complex has far too much invested in a narrative that depends on a major existential threat. They need war, and almost war. American capital will not give up its domination of its global commercial position, and they believe it depends on their military might. Oil and guns determine U.S. foreign policy, not national security. On this point alone, one can argue that the ruling class is not fit to rule. The threat of blowing up the world and their inability to deal with it. But of course, there's more. Modern industrial capitalism has given rise to the climate crisis, a clear and objective existential threat to human and all living things. I'm sure everyone here has heard the basic facts, and the process is speeding up. Leading climate science have modeled that by the year 2050, we will cross the 2-degree threshold of temperature increasing above pre-industrial temperatures. That model was based on if all the countries that signed the Paris Accords lived up to their commitments. Of course, this modeling was done before the election of a climate denier as president. So what does that mean to the model of 2050? It's possible we're crossing 2 degrees in 20 years. I mean, most people in this room are going to see it, and certainly our children are going to see it. Once that threshold is crossed, apparently it's far more difficult to slow and reverse the process. Yet, according to Media Matters, in the 2016 election, the 4 major broadcast channels, NBC, CBS, Fox, ABC, they gave climate crisis, the climate change story, 96 minutes of coverage in the entire election year. And those numbers included Fox, so most of their coverage was actually climate denial. According to a Yale poll, only 13% of people know that more than 90% of scientists believes human activity causes the climate crisis, the climate change. And of course, it's actually more like 97% of scientists. When it comes to voting, the climate crisis is barely on anyone's radar. Yet it's clearly the gravest threat humans ever faced. You would think that the elites would find it in their own interest to take action, given the apocalyptic consequence of denial or impotent action. But effective policy requires taking on the fossil fuel industry. It really requires changing how things are owned and who has power. It means transforming the economy and relations between people. They won't go there, even though the consequences are terrifying. They're not fit to rule. Artificial intelligence is here and rapidly advancing. It will soon produce a world with millions less jobs. Truck and taxi drivers, to doctors, to name the occupation. You name your occupation. Millions and millions of jobs are disappearing in the next decade or two. We're not even talking about much. The top 20% of the population won't need the rest of the 80%. They imagine a world of artificial intelligent robots creating wealth, and we're on the precipice of it. If you're a capitalist, a world with massive unemployment might not seem so bad, workers trying to compete against the cost of robots. And that's why I think the elites who think about such things are not more alarmed about climate change. Rather than take the necessary measures to transform the economy to one that's green and sustainable, they're literally planning to head for the hills. I recently introduced Rana Faruhar, who writes for the Financial Times, and she knows everyone on Wall Street. I said, you know, they have kids, they have grandkids. Don't they know what's coming? And she says, yeah, they all have escape plans. They're buying land in New Zealand, Northern Ontario. They imagine cities on the hill serviced by robots. Their greatest fear is not the cataclysmic destruction of the rest of humanity, but that AI will take over from the humans. Frankly, in that world, I'm rooting for the robots. This ruling class is not fit to rule. The digital revolution makes all this possible. It's also allowed the process of financialization and globalization to grow qualitatively to a qualitatively greater scale. Imagine creating complex derivative products with a pencil and paper. There's no Amazon or Walmart without computers to create such a beautifully efficient global supply chain. and of course to play cheap global labor off against American workers, which has basically stalled wage increases and hollowed much of the industrial working class. Why can't the ruling elites deal with the systemic threats of climate change, financial crisis, global war, and artificial intelligence? Threats to the future of their own system, because they are in the middle of an orgy of profit-making. They can't believe their good fortune. If they had any doubts before the election, now Wall Street loves Trump, but this certainly didn't start with Trump. Even though that most of finance, most of Wall Street knows that unregulated Wall Street, that it's only a matter of time before the crisis of 07-08 repeats itself. But what the hell, no one will go to jail and the public will bail them out again, they believe. And if they actually think beyond their private jets and yachts, they think that, well, we'll be okay, our kids will be okay, probably our grandchildren will be okay. And after that, après moi le déluge. After me comes the flood, said Louis XV. And in Maryland, we just saw much of a city just washed away, literally. And it's surely the shape of things to come. And anyone looks at it, and they look at it, they know this is the shape of things to come. And those individuals in the elites who see what's coming and are sounding the alarm, and there are more than a few, even they're marginalized. Of course, corporate media plays a critical role in all of this. They're far too concerned about Russiagate and Trump's tweets than the critical issues facing us, and for obvious reasons. But one wonders how the producers and journalists can live with themselves. Everything, as always, comes down to a simple question. Who has political power, and how will stuff be owned? If we have no faith in the ruling elites, and we shouldn't, then we have to change who controls government and build the public sector to challenge the power of the oligarchy. And we have to tell working people the whole truth. We can't treat people as infants, that all they can worry about is the most immediate things that face them. Working people can get the big picture as well as anyone in this room. The lead up to the 2020 elections will be a critical time to tell this whole truth, and the outcome of those elections can't be overestimated. As much as the digital revolution helped create a vile stratum of the ultra-rich, it also created the conditions for something new. The Sanders campaign has shown that political structures that were built to look democratic, because the power of the billionaires would always win out, can be challenged with mass fundraising. Online organizing and independent media can challenge the power of concentrated media ownership. And importantly, imagine a publicly owned Amazon or Apple or JP Morgan. These are essentially planned and rational economies. We've been told planned economies aren't possible. But artificial intelligence and digitization have actually created massive planned economies right in front of our eyes. But around these planned economies, the economy and politics is increasingly insane. You can't have a planned national economy with a pencil and paper. We've seen what that led to in the Soviet Union. But artificial intelligence gives us the promise of a planned, green, and sustainable economy. The problem is the tremendous promise of artificial intelligence is being strangled by private ownership, whose only objective is profit. Stephen Hawking said just before he died that in the end, the fight over who controls artificial intelligence is the greatest fight we have before us. It can't be separated from the fight to develop a rational climate policy or a more equitable society. We must assert the people's interest, from banking to technology, and most importantly, climate policy. And we must tell working people the whole truth about how urgent our situation is. All over the country and the world, people are organizing to fight for such change. And in spite of the dire moment we're in, I believe people are ready to act. When working people really get what's facing them, they'll not be fooled if we do our job. We must tell people the whole truth. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Episode 11 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Paul Jay, founder and senior editor of the Real News Network. Next up is Dr. Gerald Horn, an African-American historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African Studies at the University of Houston.
I'm going to try to sketch about 400 or 500 years of history in 10 minutes, but 15 minutes, okay. But for those who find that too oppressive, let me say that there are books, of course, over there that go into more detail. And also, I'd point you to a lecture on YouTube that I gave at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in February 2018 that sort of fleshes out some of these points. Now, the charge before us is towards a new strategy for the left, which presupposes that we need a new strategy, which presupposes further that the strategies up to this point apparently have not been very effective. Otherwise, I don't think we'd be asking for a new strategy. And the rather sobering news is that even though I'm sure, like myself, you'll be working like hell to make sure that Trumpism is defeated in November 2018 and November 2020, the fact of the matter is, I'm afraid to say, that Trumpism as a phenomenon will be with us for some time to come. It's not a one-off. It's not necessarily a deviation from the broad scope of U.S. history. It's more like a culmination for reasons I'll try to at least sketch generally. And given the fact that it may be with us for some time to come, it's well past time not only to develop a new strategy, but also perhaps to develop a new concept of why it is that U.S. imperialism exists, or more to the point, why are we in North America at this moment speaking English when we could just as well have been speaking Dutch, or just as well been speaking a number of Native American languages with simultaneous translation. And in order to get to a point that we can answer that question, it may be useful to begin with by examining a number of recent incidents and asking why. I'm sure you're familiar with the Philadelphia Starbucks incident, the barbecuing while black incident in Oakland, the black woman arrested for studying at a common space in Yale, all of the police killings of Eric Garner and Philando Castile and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland. And I think that we should begin to draw reasonable inferences from uncontested facts. That is to say, during the war in Vietnam, the question often was this genocidal war some sort of one-off, some sort of deviation from U.S. imperialism, or whether it was the logical working out of the contradictions of U.S. imperialism. And likewise, with regard to what's happening to a significant part of the citizenry of this country, we need to ask ourselves, is this just a coincidence, all of these police killings and arrests and calling the police, or is there something deeper at play? And if there is something deeper at play, what is it? Well, fortunately, I think it's also fair to say that some of the liberal scholars have been doing a fair job of answering these questions, in some ways better than the scholars who consider themselves to the left of liberalism. I mean, for example, the book by Robert Parkinson, The Common Cause, on 1776, the founding of the United States, the common cause being massive dispossession of the indigenous and continued enslavement of the Africans. Or the recent book by Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman, The Framers' Coup, and look at the Constitution. Unlike many of our friends on the left who see the Constitution as the last word and, quote, democracy, unquote, as the title of this book suggests, he takes a more pinched view, which actually is part of the schizophrenic view of many of our friends on the left who oftentimes at once celebrate this archaic, antiquated document, yet lament its fruits, be it the Electoral College, which allows a person to get fewer votes in 2016 and still be elected president, which of course stems from a decision in the late 18th century to give more weight to slave-owning states, or even the Second Amendment, which leads to these mass shootings, which can erupt at any second, and particularly they seem to be erupting in churches and high schools as of late, which, as you know, stems from this fear of uprisings by the indigenous population and uprising by enslaved Africans, and therefore there was a need for citizen militias in order to suppress them, and therefore it was decided that a better part of wisdom was to make sure that the population is armed. Now, or at least the Euro-American population is armed, I should say, to correct myself. So the point that I'm making is that if you look at the history of this country, it's fair to say that the revolt against British rule that led to the formation of the United States in the late 18th century, which has led to us communicating in this language developed in Northwest Europe, was driven in no small measure by A, the decision by London in 1763 with the Royal Proclamation to keep the settlers, led by real estate speculator number one, George Washington, from moving further west, coming into conflict with the Native Americans, causing London to expend tremendous amounts of blood and treasure to propel that illicit process. And rather than see that kind of process end, the settlers led by George Washington kicked out London. And secondly, Somerset's case in June 1772, where England abolished slavery, and there was this fear that this decision would leapfrog the Atlantic, jeopardizing fortunes of a murderer's row of founding fathers, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, etc. And they kicked London out. Now, any of you who know anything about settlers' revolts, be it Algeria in the late 1950s or Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, in 1965, know that they're inherently problematic. Or any of you who know anything about settler colonialism, be it in North America today or what used to be called historic Palestine, now Israel, for example, or Australia, beginning after, interestingly enough, the British are kicked out of what is now the United States, know that it involves mass dispossession of an indigenous population and a sort of installation into power of a favored class of individuals. And what's interesting about the United States is its construction of whiteness, that is to say, those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, British versus German, German versus Pole, German versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Greek versus Macedonian, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. Once they cross the Atlantic, voila, magically they're transmuted into this new identity politics, a militarized identity politics, if you like, of whiteness. Now, at once, this helps to reconcile conflicts and differences that they might have endured in Europe, particularly like English versus Irish, one of the first aspects of this construction of whiteness. But second of all, it's sort of what we used to call in the trade union movement a kind of pork chop unity. That is to say, they're united on this reactionary platform and premise of looting the indigenous and enslaving on a mass basis the Africans. And so I think that in terms of developing a new strategy for the left, it may be useful to go back to re-examine the history of this country, and out of the examination of the history of this country, perhaps we can develop a new strategy. I should also say that if you look at the broad expanse of North Atlantic history, it's quite striking to note how at issue in terms of mass transformations and what were thought to be progressive transformations was oftentimes the question of slavery and dispossession. I mean, if you look at the so-called Glorious Revolution in England in 1688, you see that the merchants rise up against the monarch because they want to elbow their way into the lucrative nature of the African slave trade, which oftentimes delivers profits of 1,700%. And so they clip the wings of the monarch and then call for the deregulation of the African slave trade and free trade in Africans, which leads to people like myself winding up in North America, or as noted about 1776, a similar process, or 1836 with Texas seceding from Mexico because Mexico had moved towards abolition in the 1820s, and then the final defeat in 1861 with the Confederate States of America. So given the fact that profit through enslavement has been a driving force in the history of the North Atlantic nations, particularly in the United States of America, it should not be surprising that we see these incidents in Oakland and in Philadelphia, et cetera, nor should it be surprising that given the fact that one of the largest uncompensated expropriations of private property up to that point was the expropriation of property in the bodies of enslaved Africans in 1865, oftentimes when describing this to my students, and being students in 2018, they're oftentimes fiddling with their smartphones as I'm talking, and I'll go up and grab their smartphone and say, this is what's called an uncompensated expropriation of private property, and I'm sure you're not happy about that. You might even want to take me outside and thrash me. Well, this is, of course, what happened in 1865 in Dixie, so no wonder a Ku Klux Klan arises. No wonder we're still bedeviled by the legacy of that rather tortured and troubled history. And little wonder that many of our elite analysts are talking about fascism today, be it Madeleine Albright in her book Fascism, A Warning, or the Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein and Can It Happen Here?, a play on the novel It Can't Happen Here from the 1930s about the rise of fascism, or the deceased novelist Philip Roth in his book, The Plot Against America, Michael Kinsley, or Timothy Snyder of Yale in Tyranny and the Road to Unfreedom, unfreedom, of course, being sort of a euphemism for fascism, or Michael Kinsley, an heir to the Microsoft fortune through marriage, who first sounded the alarm about Trump as a fascist. But the problem with their analyses is not, number one, they don't seem to see a connection between fascism arising in a country that tolerated slavery and apartheid for centuries and decades, and how that creates a fertile womb for the rise of fascism, I guess because they think it's normalized behavior to treat black people in a fascist manner, and that everybody else can sort of go along and escape, basically. And number two, with regard to U.S. foreign policy, they don't draw a connection between helping to engineer a fascist coup in Chile on September 11, 1973, or backing apartheid South Africa into a mixed tactical retreat in the spring of 1994. They don't see a connection between that foreign policy and how that creates the seeds for fascism here. That's where we should be able to intervene. And the other historical point I'd like to make is that if you look at the broad expanse of history over the last few hundred years, you'll see that in the North Atlantic nations in particular, there has been this transition from religious conflict, Protestant versus Catholic in Great Britain, for example, and Catholic versus Muslim in terms of the Crusades, and Catholic Christian versus Jewish, for example, in Europe. And then crossing the Atlantic and then the advent of settler colonialism, you see, as particularly embodied in the First Amendment, a transition from religion as an axis of society to race as an axis of society. And of course, many of our liberal historians, they'll celebrate the First Amendment, talking about this movement away from religious sectarianism, but don't flip the coin over and look that it's really just replaced by race. And the same holds true for colonialism as well, which oftentimes was pivoted upon the point of race. Now, what happens to change that oftentimes are external events. The Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, leads to a general crisis of the entire slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, which then, with slavery abolished, that helps to give impetus to a class-based movement. It's no accident that struggles for an eight-hour day, the struggles of the Knights of Labor and union movements erupt in North America, in particular, after the U.S. Civil War and the abolition of slavery. But what's happened as we've gone from this transition from religion to race to class is that obviously the class-based project has suffered grievous wounds, so there's no surprise surprise that, for example, in Italy, which once boasted one of the largest and most significant left-wing movements in the capitalist world, now you have the rise of a certain kind of neo-fascism. Nor is it surprising that in North America, in the 1950s, when the fateful decision was made to retreat from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow, by dint of Brown versus Board of Education, followed by Civil Rights Acts, etc., at the same time, you have this advance on the race front, you have a retreat on the class front, because that's accompanied by this Red Scare attack on progressive trade unions, International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union, National Maritime Union, etc. And so that leads to this rather blinkered idea that the U.S. ruling elite cares more about black people than they do about the so-called white working class, because, as you know, class is a race phenomenon. When you talk about class, you only could talk about the white working class. And then that helps to plant seeds that then gives rise to this phenomenon of Trumpism. But I think to conclude, the point that I'm trying to make is that if you look at the broad expanse and broad scope of North American settler colonialism followed by U.S. history, that progressive transformation oftentimes has been induced by external factors, be it the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, be it the rise of a socialist camp and national liberation movements that puts pressure on the United States to move away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. And so part of the lesson in terms of developing a new strategy for the left and to make it and to put it on a micro level is that in a few weeks there will be an election in Mexico where a left-wing candidate is now leading in the polls, but of course he's led in the polls before and has been defeated. But let's say that this proves out, it seems to me that that opens up a wonderful opportunity for the left, particularly given the large population of Mexican descent, not only in the Southwest in California, but also right here in New York City, where we can link the local and the global. We can begin to expand the battlefield to our benefit. And then finally, taking advantage of what Trump has done for us. What has he done for us, you ask? Well, he's helped to introduce rifts into the capitalist world. I'm sure you must have seen what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said. And of course, he's not necessarily one of our radical left friends, but I think that it reflects a growing sentiment in Canada with regard to what's happening in the United States, with regard to what's happening in Germany concerning this negative reaction to Trumpism. We already know about the growth of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. So I think there's a possibility for creating this global movement that we can now facilitate because we have such useful instruments as the Real News. We have the use of the internet, which allows us to communicate instantaneously around the world. And then we have these large populations of immigrants that are coming under fire who, even if we weren't thinking strategically and globally, we would be duty-bound to come to their defense and assistance in any case. But we have even more of an opportunity and a reason to come to their defense and aid because now we see it as part of a larger global strategy based on history, based on the history of progress in North America, that then will undergird a new strategy for the left. Thank you very much.
You're listening to episode 11 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Dr. Gerald Horn, an African-American historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African Studies at the University of Houston. Next up is Juan D. Gonzalez, an award-winning broadcast journalist, investigative reporter, and co-host of Democracy Now!
Good evening, and thank you to the Left Forum for inviting me. I'm not quite sure why you invited me to speak here. I don't have prepared remarks because I've been involved with a bunch of other things lately. I didn't have the time to get them prepared, but I think I basically have a good understanding of what the thrust and the direction of this conference is and what you're hoping to come away with from this conference, which is not only strategy but hope. and I come to bring you hope. Because I am, despite all of the dire problems that we face today, I come increasingly sensing that there is great hope for social progress and among social movements not only in the United States, but in the rest of the world. Now, I've spent now 40 years working as a journalist, earning my living as a journalist, not as a political analyst. I've done quite a bit of work in terms of understanding the history of different institutions and groups with which I have grown up with throughout my life. And we just celebrated a few weeks ago the 50th anniversary of the Columbia student strike, of which I was a participant back in 1968. And I was able to spend about 10 years before I became a professional journalist as a social and community activist in a variety of organizations, not just the Students for Democratic Society, but then the Young Lords Party, the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, the African Liberation Support Committee. Even as I continued working as a professional journalist, I had the opportunity at different stages in my journey through journalism to help organize my fellow journalists in labor actions, surprisingly, all of which turned out to be pretty successful. We had in 1985 a 5-week strike in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Daily News and Philadelphia Inquirer, where we won, I think, the last great contract of any newspaper union in America back in 1985. A few years later, in 1990-91, I had the good fortune or bad fortune to have been involved and be a strike leader of the New York Daily News strike, which lasted for 5 months, and which we also somehow managed to defeat one of these giant media companies, the Tribune Company. And then, of course, back in 2000-2001, the big battle we had at Pacifica to try to prevent the corporate takeover of Pacifica, which lasted over a year. Won for that period of time. Things have changed over the years, but at least it was able to prevent that. So I've had the good fortune to have participated in many mass struggles over the years, which have managed to win their goals. Back in 1968, we all thought a new world was dawning. In 1968 and 69. We thought the revolution was just around the corner. As Paul has mentioned, capitalism has proven to be an amazingly resilient system. We always had the argument, does the base determine the superstructure, or superstructure determine base? Well, capitalism has always been able to figure out its threats to it and come up with new ways to maintain its power. And, of course, it was helped along the line by the collapse of the socialist experiments of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and opening up all these new markets that previously had been shut off to the to world capitalist development. So I think that I've tried to deal with my own ability to be involved in these struggles and somehow win immediate success against the larger problem that we all face, that the capitalist system has continued to become more entrenched throughout the world. And so that would seem to indicate a pessimistic analysis. Well, I think one of the things that is most important to grab hold of, I always had this argument with Amy Goodman, my co-host of Democracy Now!, and others. I believe the most important thing that happened in the 20th century was that the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America stood up. Colonialism, the old system of colonialism, was ended in the 20th century. Now, it happened because and this is my own analysis, some historians might differ with me on this, the necessity of all of the various imperialist nations when they went into World War II to win the war required them to drive their colonial subjects into their armies and required them to go to the colonies and come up with more soldiers to fight. As a result, you see, if anyone who studies the civil rights movement in the United States, who studies the rise of the Mexican-American and Puerto Rican movement in the United States, that studies the rise of the anti-colonial movements around the world, realizes that it was many of the colonial soldiers who fought in World War II who came back to the colonies and demanded the same kinds of freedom and independence that Europe and the United States were espousing. So that the necessity to impress the colonial subjects into World War II laid the basis for the independence movements that arose afterwards, whether it was in India or in Algeria or throughout much of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And then something else started to happen. The Third World started coming to the West. After World War II, you started having all of these mass flows of people from those colonies to the colonizer nations. What is the main thing propelling most of the fascist movements in the advanced capitalist world today? It's anti-immigrant fervor, anti-immigrant xenophobia. In France, they don't know what to do about all the Tunisians and the Moroccans and the Algerians. In England, they don't know what to do about all the Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans. In Germany, they don't know what to do about all the Turks. In the United States, they don't know what to do about all the Latin Americans and Caribbeans and others from the Third World that have come to the West. When you look at the immigrant flows, the people have come precisely from the nations that once were their colonial masters. The reason there are so many Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in France is because those were the colonies of France. The reason there are so many Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans in England is because those were the colonies of England. And the reason there are so many Latin Americans in the United States, no matter what Trump or any of the others say, is because Latin America was the incubator of the American overseas empire. It was where all the great multinational companies were first born, in Latin America. So what we have seen increasingly is that the Third World has come to the West and has totally begun to transform the actual compositions of these nations. And as a result, there's an increasing backlash from the old members of those nations. Who is a Frenchman? Who is an Englishman? Who is an Englishman? Who is a German? Even who is a Swede today? And so there are all of these battles, and people are trying to grab onto the past when it cannot be grabbed onto. Unfortunately, what has happened increasingly as migrant flows have moved the Third World into the West, there is now a whole new consciousness, I believe, in the working class of these countries. Who is the working class? But not the working class that you see on TV, saying that they're all Trump supporters. Who is the real working class of America today? The people who are doing the hardest work, and you find that there's been enormous transformation of the working classes of these countries, and I think this is what is fueling the rise of this new fascist movement, this unease, this sense of fear that the nation that they once knew is changing and has to be stopped. It can't be stopped, of course, because you cannot have a capitalist world where you increasingly break down barriers for capital flows while you erect walls and barriers for labor. You cannot do that. If you are going to reduce the barriers for capital, you must also reduce the barriers for labor to be able to move freely around the world. So I think that that's the big picture. Now, let me get quickly to what I think is what you're looking for more is in terms of strategy. I've spent 40 years now as a journalist basically covering urban America, covering life in urban America, politics in urban America, land policies, tax policies, political leadership. So I think I have gotten a fairly good grasp over the years of what is happening in urban America. And I believe that the key to progressive and radical change increasingly is in our cities. Now, you've got to keep your eye on the national and the state and do the best you can to affect change there. But the reality is that throughout the advanced capitalist world, national governments and regional governments are increasingly growing right-wing. And however, the cities, which are much more diverse and inclusive and hold the majority of the populations of all of these countries, are increasingly going to the left because they are responding to grassroots movements that have developed in many of these cities. And that's part of what I try to talk about in Reclaiming Gotham, how this movement post Great Recession, post-Occupy, there's been a phenomenal growth of radical and progressive grassroots movement, electing people to office, then getting into key positions at office and actually practicing a different type of governance. Because you can criticize capitalist system and the problems of the capitalist system all day long. You have to have a vision of how you would govern differently. What you would do differently. And we have lots of examples of failures of progressive and socialist and left-wing thinking. So we've got to actually be able to provide examples of progressive and radical governance that actually improve the lives of people. So whether it's Anne Hidalgo in Paris or Ada Colau in Barcelona or Sadiq Khan in London or Gail McLaughlin in California, or Chukwu Lumumba in Jackson, or Raz Baraka in Newark, or Bill de Blasio here. And I'm not saying that they don't have their problems, every one of them. But the reality is you have movements that have developed, progressive movements that are beginning to seize power in these cities and provide a different perspective and vision of how you can govern. So I think that's the first thing. Local struggles that hold people accountable and gain power and show examples of progressive governance at the local level. Second is build the broadest possible unity among progressives. I remember back in 1968 and we were in SDS and it was Nixon running against Humphrey. And of course, no one liked Humphrey. But we in SDS had the slogan, vote in the streets, vote with your feet. Do not vote in that election. Do not vote. So many of the left boycotted the 1968 election. In retrospect, I think it was one of my biggest mistakes in terms of what Nixon represented from then on as the beginning of the right-wing onslaught that it went on for years. So I think that there were other examples over those years of the sectarianism of some of us on the left that refuse to recognize that we can have differences with folks, but treat them with respect and try to find the unities that we can have with anyone who is seeking to build a better life. And that we can find a way to look for the unities first and not for the differences. So I think that the first key issue of any, key point of any strategy is one, build local grassroots movement and effectively govern. Two, build the broadest possible unity you can. And then the final critical dividing line between liberals or progressives and radicals is, do you oppose empire? Do you oppose imperial wars of your own government? Do you oppose your own governments continuing to attack and intervene in other countries? And do you oppose the restoration of white supremacy? That those are, to me, the key issues. Build a strong local base. Make the revolution locally first before you try to make it nationally. Two, build the broadest possible unity. And three, oppose imperial war, impose empire of your own government. Not that, you could oppose other governments, but the key thing is oppose your own government's attempts to build empire. And to me, those are the three key points that I hope you will take away for whatever strategy you believe out of this conference is the one that you're going to pursue. Thank you.
You're listening to Episode 11 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Juan D. Gonzalez, an award-winning broadcast journalist, investigative reporter, and co-host of Democracy Now! Next, we'll hear Juan Gonzalez respond to two questions.
To some degree, I believe that the rise of Bernie Sanders was made possible by the fact that there were already these local struggles going on in various cities and across the country, and people then gravitated toward a national spokesman for what a movement that was already in existence. And I think that, again, many of us in this room have been at this for a long time. and I think that the reality is you do not build power to make social transformation in a deep way unless you educate and organize people at the local level. Because you don't, it's not just a question of seizing power. It's a question of transforming people. It's because if anything that was taught to us by the social experiments of Russia and China and so many of these other countries, it's not sufficient just to seize the political power. You have to transform the society. And you can't. And the way you transform the society is by organizing and building a new way of looking at the world. And I don't think you do that top down. You do that bottom up. And so why I believe that it's important to that none of these local elected officials that I name would have been able to come to power unless there were already movements at the grassroots level that were developing and then saw in them at that particular moment the best expression of what that movement was about. And so I think that, and then you constantly have to hold them accountable, because I don't care who they are. Once they get into power, power is an aphrodisiac. it changes people. So you have to constantly hold them accountable. And you're not guaranteed that the people who you sent up into power are going to be the same people 2 years later or 5 years later or 8 years later. And so it's a constant battle. For first to build a movement that gets people into a position where they can actually affect policies and governance, but then holding those people accountable. And sometimes you're not going to win. But that doesn't mean you don't fight just because you're not going to win. you just have to keep at it. And I think, so that my sense is that too many people get fixated at what's happening at the national level and not sufficiently at the grassroots level. The best thing I think that Bernie Sanders did after he was not able to win the nomination of the Democratic Party is he told his followers, run for office yourself. Build movements at the local level. Make the revolution, the political revolution that I've been talking about at your local level as best as possible. On the housing issue, there is no doubt in my mind, and I've said so repeatedly, not only did de Blasio administration, but many of the, quote, progressive or liberal mayors around the country have not addressed the reality that gentrification continues to spread and market forces continue to run amok in every major city in America. And more working class and low-income people are being forced out. That is not only a reality now, but this has been a gathering crisis. Back in 1968, a commission appointed by President Johnson, the Commission on the American City, said back in 1968, 50 years ago, that the private market left to its own will never build low-cost housing. That only government intervention could assure low-cost housing in America. And it said in 1968 that there was a housing crisis. And that crisis has continued to accelerate. We all see it with the homeless population, whether you go to Seattle or L.A. or New York or D.C. It doesn't matter where you go. But the problem is
that the federal governments and the state governments have completely gotten out of doing any kind of intervention on the housing market. So therefore, you're a progressive mayor in a capitalist system, and you're trying to figure out how are you going to build housing when you have no federal help, no state help. So what a lot of these mayors have done is they've said to the private sector, the only thing that we have is height. We can rezone and build higher and maybe get you to give us some crumbs of affordable housing. It's not a good strategy. It's a weak strategy. It's going to further accelerate gentrification. And I completely agree with all the housing activists who were opposed to the rezonings of the de Blasio administration. And I've continually been critical of that. However, housing is not the only issue that's being dealt with. It's a critical issue. I look back, and let me give you the names. William O'Dwyer, Vincent Impellitteri, Robert Wagner, John Lindsay, Abe Beam, Ed Koch, Dave Dinkins, Rudy Giuliani, Michael Bloomberg. Those are all the mayors of New York City since Fiorello LaGuardia was mayor over 70 years ago. None of them, including Lindsay, who probably was close to the best, none of them have had a more overall progressive policies of a range of issues than Bill de Blasio has. That doesn't mean that Bill de Blasio is perfect, but it means how far back do you want to go before you find somebody that is at least you can be supportive of in some of their policies. Not all of them. You're not going to agree with them on all of the policies. Yes, what part of stop and frisk? The part that ended stop and frisk, or the part...
People get stopped, but they haven't committed a crime.
Yes, I agree with you. It's still happening. Why? Because every mayor in America, whether progressive, conservative, or centrist, has to deal with the fact the police departments are the army of every city. They have their own mind. You as a political leader have to figure out how you deal with the fact that you have an army that could be hostile to you and that doesn't necessarily go along with your policies. So what I'm saying is that, we can have this argument. You can have it in any city in America. There'll never be a mayor that meets all of our needs until we live in a different kind of society. But you have to decide at any stage in your struggle who is at least representing a good portion of what you're trying to get, and you continue to criticize them on those things that they have clearly fallen short on.
You've been listening to episode 11 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features audio from the Saturday night plenary of the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled One Fight, Many Fronts. It includes talks by Paul Jay, Dr. Gerald Horn, and Juan D. Gonzalez. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening.